The Business of Biotech is produced by Life Science Connect and its community of learning, solving, and sourcing resources for biopharma decision makers. If you're working on biologics process development and manufacturing challenges, you need to swing by bioprocessonline.com. If you're trying to stay ahead of the cell or gene therapy curve, visit cellandgene.com. When it's time to map out your clinical course, let clinicalleader.com help. And if optimizing outsourcing decisions is what you're after, check out outsourcepharma.com. We're Life Science Connect, and we're here to help. With some 20 life sciences startups under his belt, Triumvira President and COO Rob Williamson is the definition of a serial biotech entrepreneur. An economist by training, he's led companies developing virtually every biologic modality and cumulatively addressing perhaps the broadest range of indications I've yet to see. Why does he take on the projects he takes on? How do his battle scars, deals won and deals lost, inform the decisions he's making now? Why does he think he's got a winner in Triumvira, a CAR T-cell company trying to crack the solid tumor nut? And with so many new approaches to oncology therapeutics, some disparate and some complementary, what's got him most excited for the future? I'm Matt Piller. This is The Business of Biotech. And I caught up with Williamson in San Francisco to learn about his biotech leadership thought process and where he sees cancer therapy going next. Let's give it a listen.
Robert Williamson, President and CEO, Director of Triumvira. I want to start with you before we get into what Triumvira is doing, because you've got a, I dig through the LinkedIn profile and do an assessment of the CV. And what jumped out at me as very interesting is the fact that you studied economics. You worked for Alan Greenspan before dipping your toe into biotech back in the early 90s. So you're studying economics. You're working in the federal government. Just give me a brief synopsis of how you came to be a biotech founder.
So I was an economist. I was supposed to get my PhD in economics, and I was at the heart of monetary policy. So when you hear the Fed is raising or lowering interest rates, there was a handful of people working on that, and I was the junior person in that group. Mm-hmm. And my bosses all looked at me and said, you know, you can go get your PhD, you can publish, you can go to MIT or Stanford graduate school and get your, and then I said, well, what do I do after that? So, well, you can come back here and do more of this. Or you teach and you try not to teach because you really need to publish.
Yeah.
I said, that just sounds awful. And they said, we thought you'd think that. So we really suggest you go to business school because you're really a, you're an entrepreneur at heart and you should go do that. Mm-hmm. So I went to business school and I got into, I couldn't spell DNA, but I got recruited by one of the big consulting firms, and the head of the healthcare practice was in my two doors down, my summer internship, and he recruited me to the healthcare practice, and I learned all about pharma and devices and fun stuff like that.
Just learned as you went?
Learned as I went.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, no doubt you've already ascertained as we met this morning that it's already been a hectic morning for you here at the JP Morgan show.
Yeah.
But hectic, apparently by the looks of your CV is embraced because you've been, 20 life sciences companies that you've either launched, led or directed, since that time when you made that decision to come into the space. What keeps a guy like you going? Like, what keeps a guy like you going and just doing that over and over again and signing up for it?
It's a great question because sometimes I ask myself, and what keeps us going? And my wife is a biotech CFO, and she and I were she and I were in Hawaii last week, and I was getting calls at 4 a.m. for a couple of different companies working on things we were announcing this week at JPM, and she said, you know, are we going to keep doing this? You know, how long are we going to keep doing this? And I joke with her. I say, I just want to be involved with curing one more disease and then I can call it quits. Just one more. And that, you just, when you have success, it's so intoxicating, the impact you have, that you want to see it again. You may never see it, and it keeps you going. But it's just fantastic when you see patients benefit from what you're doing. So that's what keeps you going. Really is. I mean, and obviously if things work out, you do well economically, you do well, you have bragging rights with your friends and all those, you know, things that
Sure, give you a sense of pride.
But a sense of pride and accomplishment. But it's really, it's true. You hear it sounds trite, but when you really impact patients, it's kind of life-changing.
Yeah, I believe it. Your wife, I'm going to have to take a note. You don't have to share it right now if you don't want to, the biotech that she works for, but perhaps I'll have Mrs. Williamson on the...
Jacoby. She has a different name, but yes, Janessa. Okay. Yeah, she is a CFO at another biotech.
I'll look her up, and hopefully when I ask her to come on the show with me, you'll give her your highest recommendation.
Oh, yeah, she's smarter than me.
The other interesting thing about the companies that you've led is that, I mean, if you kind of tick through the boxes, you've covered all, you've led companies that cover all sorts of modalities for a giant range of indications. Like, and to me, like, I think very simplistically, I think, well, boy, at your stage in life, having all that experience with multiple modalities, multiple indications, from recombinant proteins to antibodies to ADCs, antivirals, genomics, like you've covered them all. Now you're at a point where, I mean, the world is, in terms of what you do next.
Yes.
You've got the experience to say, okay, well, you know, I don't want to do that because I don't see that as where things are going. So tell me a little bit about that. Why you joined Tri and Vera, like what?
A little over a year ago.
Yeah. So you made that decision with a backlog of incredible experience. Why Triumvira? And more importantly, why right now?
With Triumvira, one of the key investors who I was friendly with just said, hey, we're seeing some interesting data. A guy like you could help us out. And caught me in a moment of weakness where I was willing to take a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And so I jumped in on it. And I do have a very broad set of experience. I tend to gravitate towards companies that are close to getting in the clinic through about phase one, phase two. Okay. That's sort of my sweet spot. When I was a consultant, I did commercial launches and everything like that. But I've started a couple diagnostic companies, you name it, some tool companies, tool companies. Mm-hmm. But I've really gravitated towards therapeutics in that range. And if the clinical data is reading out and or there's thinking to be done on how you sort of optimize the product and get it to the patients as fast and best you can, that's where I get the most excited.
So. Why is preclinical through, early clinical through phase one your sweet spot?
It's just my happy place. Yeah. There's a lot of prioritization that needs to be done. So if you're a company and you've got most biotechs with really good science have a lot of opportunities, but not all the resources. And you need to prioritize which opportunity you're going to spend your most time on and what's your second and third. There's a lot of second, third, and fourth order implications to decisions. And it ends up being incredibly strategic and complex. And if you get it right, very fulfilling. And so that's why I really... And I also enjoy interpreting clinical data, my statistician background, from being an economist and a statistician, mm-hmm. really looking at the data, thinking about, hey, is this real or not, or what's real, and can you parse through it? It's really what I like to do. And the flip side is often there's a lot of partnering and financing around this data, and the deal making side is the other great, where my forte can be in the fundraising and the deal making.
How is that? That's a segue I can't ignore. How has that forte been playing out the past 2.5 years when deal making has been, coming at a premium?
It's been tough. Right when the market was starting to fall apart, I snuck in $100 million crossover round for a company and got that done, and it was brutal near the end.
Yeah.
Investors pulling out, term sheets being withdrawn, and just wrapping everyone's. Getting arm in arm and saying, just do this and get it done. It was very brutal. And since then, it's been very tough. Not going to lie. That being said, there are certain spots that have been brighter than others. So recently, probably for the last 12 months, nuclear oncology has been incredibly hot. Alpha Particles, I'm involved in a public company there. And I've seen a lot of interest in cash flow and recent deal making. BMS just bought a company for $4 billion that had only recently gone public at $1 billion. Before that was private at a couple hundred million. So, you know, just astronomical valuations. Mm-hmm. So there are bright spots, but it's been really tough. And the key there comes back to the previous point I was making, which is then you're a company, you have X dollars, you need to make the wisest choice you can with the money you have and make it and invest what few precious dollars you have in these winter, you know, these storms, these nuclear winters, as we call them.
Yeah.
You have to make the right choices. And I've been through a couple. So,
Do indication and modality, especially in a time like this when resources are thinner, do those play into your calculus?
They do, but they also in a way don't, right? So everyone got worried about small molecules with the IRA Act, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone said, you know, we don't want to do small molecules because reimbursement and stuff. But if you look at private investment, small molecules continue to dominate the private investment space. So to some degree, if you are, in my mind, addressing an unmet need and a need that isn't about to be met by everyone else, you know, being the 30th CD19 CAR T companies is not exciting.
Right.
And they've all pivoted to saying now we're going to do lupus, which has its own issues. So I think you want to be differentiated, but you can be differentiated in a space that's maybe not sexy right now, but you will persevere and ultimately be successful, I think, if your technology pans out.
Yeah. All right. So that's another nice segue to talk about the technology. So I'm hoping you can spend a little bit of time without going too deep into the canned JP Morgan pitch, right?
Sure.
Spend a little bit of time talking about what Triumvirate is working on and how it might differ from other T-cell therapies.
Yeah, Triumvirate is a really interesting technology. It's a CAR T, but with a more regulatory, built-in regulatory mechanism. So CAR T, the T-cells that are engineered essentially do not self-regulate. So it works really well in liquid tumors, but they exhaust, they're not durable. Mm. And Triumvirate out of McMaster in Canada worked on a way of basically trying to mimic natural T cell mechanisms with the engineered T cells that you put back into people. And there are these regulatory domains on the cell surface and inside the cell that they've replicated from a natural T cell environment. And that's keeping it at a super high level. Mm-hmm. So it looks and acts more like a real T cell. So you don't get some of the liabilities, the toxicologies, and also the sort of super hot and then die that you get with traditional CAR T therapies. The other thing Triumvirate is doing that's different than most CAR T companies, or at least historically, is going after solid tumors and not liquid tumors. That there's pros and cons to that. Mm-hmm. Not many people are going after solid tumors. The reason is it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to get the T cells to really get into that tumor microenvironment and kill the solid tumors. I think Triumvirate has seen some very interesting clinical data, and we're going to turn a couple more cards this year and see what happens.
Okay. Yeah. Can you share it all? I don't want to get too deep into the science here, but can you share it all? What the strategy is to overcome that challenge, or that being so hard?
Yeah, it's there's a couple of things. One is you hope that sort of our natural or mimicking of a more natural T cell response gives you the repeat kill. Mm-hmm. And the durability. We also and other companies are doing this as well, but we're able to do it more aggressively as we can redose with our therapy too. So there's. You have to do lymphodepletion and you dose, and there's a lot of liabilities with cell therapy in terms of certainly with traditional CAR T's with toxicology. We don't have that with our construct and our approach, or at least most of them. And or if we do see like cytokine release, we have very, very low levels of it versus really high. So our therapy is so safe that it can be. Unlike other cell therapies, it can be an outpatient procedure. You don't have to stay in the hospital or in the ER to make sure you don't have an adverse reaction. We've had patients get it and just mild fevers walk out. Mm-hmm. So redosing highly safe, and the safety allows us to give more cells and et cetera and so forth. So we'll see how it pans out. We've had some nice tumor responses, and we're currently focusing very aggressively on a target called CLDN18.2, which is a increasingly exciting target in the space. There's been some data out there with an antibody that's compelling, and we're near the front of the pack, certainly with cell therapies going after that target.
Yeah,
solid tumors, and that's good for gastric and gastroesophageal tumors. It's a very underserved cancer area.
Where are you on the clinical continuum?
We have a phase two with our HER2 program, and we have a phase one with the CLDN program. The CLDN program is actually probably becoming more of a priority given market evolution.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to watch then. Phase two and phase one. We'll see where Rob Williamson ends up next.
It's going to be an interesting 12 months. We'll see. You never know. And I'm very excited about that company, and I'm involved with other companies too. It's very, for better or worse, the companies I've been helping, some startups, a public company I'm on the board of, and Triumvirate, they're all oncology. So I'm looking at it from all these different perspectives, cell therapy, degraders, radio oncology. And it's amazing when I look at how we're all coming at, all these companies are coming at cancer in different directions, in different ways, but experiencing a lot of similar challenges. The body is incredibly complicated.
Yeah. Do you, not that I'm going to ask you to place any public bets, but it's a great point to bring up. I mean, oncology is cancer is being attacked from so many different perspectives. Obviously Triumvirate, any other approaches that are exciting you right now?
I really like the radio oncology space for probably a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the board of the public company called Perspective Therapeutics. We just announced a deal with another company today, Lantheus, with a couple of our programs. I looked at radio oncology when I was an antibody company in the 2000s, where we had a very popular areas, conjugated antibodies, right? ADCs, antibody drug conjugates. And we were developing ADCs, but we were also looking at conjugating nuclear isotopes onto our antibodies for delivery. So delivering, and now people are coming back to that again, but now we're using a much, much safer or better tolerated nuclear isotopes. And people are attaching them to different targeting mechanisms to go after cancers, right? And so I really do like radio oncology. I think it's gotten very crowded and very frothy in the last 6 months, 12 months.
Yeah.
But I think for certain cancers, it's going to be a game changer in the very near future, which is because it's going to be interesting to see. So I think a lot of patients are going to benefit from it.
I just had here, as a matter of fact, so it'll be a couple episodes before this one airs, Ratio Therapeutics, Jack Hoffman.
Yeah.
It's an interesting space for me because we're rooted in biologics. I think in Ratio's case, you know, they're attaching radioisotope to a small molecule.
Yes.
But the delivery mechanisms are...
You're just trying to get that isotope to the tumor and only to the tumor, ideally. And then you have it kill and get out of the body.
Yeah.
There are different ways of doing it. The other really interesting thing that I love, and I've seen different companies doing this, is it's the same concept, but a different use, is you see so much gene editing going on. And the challenge is in editing and in vivo and the human body editing. So not ex vivo, but in vivo editing. And there's in vivo CAR T, which I think has strengths and weaknesses. But the trick has been and continues to be getting that editing mechanism to the right part of the body at the right time, the right place. In fact, not only the right organ, but the right cells in the organ, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
And the liver tends to grab things. So you have liquid nanoparticles, you know, LNPs are everyone's trying to target those. I think over time, we're going to see, and a lot of people are working on this, over time, the real killer app is going to be being able to deliver that gene editing to the right cell and the right organ at the right time, ideally. And that's evolving. I see lots of companies working on it. I don't have a clear winner, but I know that that is incredibly important as we think about therapeutic intervention going forward. And there are a lot of people going after it in different ways, but it excites me, right? When I see a company who's got something there, I say, that's impressive.
Another hint of where Rob Williams might be going.
I see those things and I get very excited. I get, and if there's a startup and they say, oh, we've got this, but we can't raise money, I'm like, here's, go this way, go there and go do this and go do that. So, yeah.
In the time we have left, I know you're on a tight time frame here, and I don't blame you. This is the place to be busy.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I just want to touch on a few more things regarding your strategic and financial objectives. So in your role, you're charged with strategic partnering, financing, and future IPO efforts for Triumvera. So I guess just share with us a little bit about your strategies in each of those, like starting with partnering.
So partnering is great. I tell my teams this, and I've been saying this for so many years now, it gets around. I say, you won't get a partnership or an acquisition until you don't want one, where you love what you have so much, you want to keep it for yourself. Then the partners come running in or the acquisitions come running in. I say
because it's lovable, right?
Yeah, I mean, they sense the love. Yes, early in my career, when I was a junior consultant, and the senior partner said, "Rob, you got to be confident because the clients can smell fear." And I think in partnering, they can smell success. You know, in a room, it's not what's said; it's what's exuded by body language, by tone, by attitude. And so much when you have something that you know is great, it comes across incredibly well.
That's even more under the microscope in a tough market like this.
Yes, it is. And big pharma have been culling their own pipeline. There have been reductions. It's changing right now, where I feel the pendulum swinging. But no one in the last 2 years would take a risk on an unproven technology. And even Triumvera, we talk to people and they say, we want to do a deal with you as soon as you have unequivocal data, efficacy data in your phase two.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I say, when we have that, we're going to go public.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So thanks. You know, if you want to partner now, maybe you can get a piece of that.
Yeah.
So it's partnering is generally happens when you don't want to partner or you don't need to partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I've always looked at it. And that's generally in the market recently, it's been having, I call it virtually unequivocal efficacy data in the clinic, which we haven't had yet. We had a phase one with some hints of efficacy that was exciting.
Yeah.
And really other data points that were pointing in a good direction. And it's probably going to stay that way. But I do feel it shifting a bit, where people may, and in fact, the deal we announced today for my nuclear oncology company, the partnership was around assets that are relatively unproven, but they were willing to make some investments to have a first dibs on it as those assets mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can see that happen more broadly as people are willing to take a little more risk. And you have to structure it as a win-win for both parties.
Sure.
Absolutely. You need to sit there and say, well, we get upside, you get upside. I mean, let's figure that out.
Has that win-win changed? Like are you feeling any pressure around terms of deals right now related to maybe what you were experiencing 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, sure. It's. I think we've gone, and again, I think the nadir is past, I hope, at this point. My suspicion is that, but again, I with investors and with partners, I try to put myself squarely in their shoes, understand what they're thinking about, and understand what risks I would be willing to take if I were in their shoes. And certainly a year ago, there was in a larger pharma, there was no risk taking at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was on all the deals you saw, the few deals you saw were true plug and plays into a commercial pipeline, direct plug and plays, where there was a clear commercial path. The Zapar developed, well into phase two data.
Yeah.
If not in phase three, if not a launch, post launch, and then say, okay, we see your launch, we see the traction, we're going to buy that. So, but I do think it's pivoting back, and I hope it gets. I don't want it to get too frothy. I think there was an overabundance of biotech funding and the like, but it would be good to see it be certainly not a desert.
Yeah,
as it was in the last year.
Yeah. Right. All right. So before I let you go, give us your best pithy wisdom or advice for folks who are in your shoes 20 companies ago and getting into biotech foundations for the first time.
Sure. Boy, I was just talking to one of my colleagues. We were talking about regrets on the walk over here.
Oh, really?
Career regrets, things we wish we'd done.
Oh, we'll do an episode on that down the road when you've got more time for it.
Yeah, and it was interesting. His was he wished he had stood up to fight a deal that he thought ended up tanking the company he was at, but his CEO told him he thought his CEO was about to fire him, so he didn't speak up any further.
Hmm.
My first biotech I left my high-paying consulting job. I made partner and I left. No one ever makes partner and says, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I was the first to do it, apparently, in forever, and it started a trend for a while. And I went to the company, and it was one of the first companies decoding the human genome. And Insight, Celera, and a couple other companies were out there. And within 8 months, I helped raise a bunch of money. I'm not bragging, I'm just saying it was that kind of environment. And then Insight came in and put a term sheet down for $450 million to buy us. And I thought, done, this is easy.
Yeah,
do it. And I was going to make a lot of money, have an exit, have a win. And one of the board members said, you know, I'm going to say who they were. I want double that because my partners in my firm are tech partners and they're getting really big returns. And so I want to try to match.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, that deal went away. The next offer we had was half that. And then the board said, can you get back to the first offer we had? And I drew a chart on my board, just the downward spiral of valuation and ultimately just selling it for parts. And so I guess my lesson is if you have a deal that looks pretty good, just take it.
Yeah,
don't second guess it. The other one is when you have money, don't think you're going to get any more. Treat it like it's your last raise. But even more importantly, think about how you're going to create compelling, if not game-changing data with the money you've just raised. Like make sure, and you have buffer for failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so many biotechs, we say this all the time, but most people, and some companies raise, and they get these crazy raises and frothy environments, and then they just hire up and they get really dopey and they become effectively, I don't want to say it too negatively, they become the problem that they're supposed to be solving. They become big pharma like as a small biotech. They're not nimble, they're not making the key decisions on rationing and prioritization. So my advice is always act like it's, you know, the scarcity principle. And I had an investor / strategic investor probably 7 years ago make me buy the book Scarcity and say, read this. This is how this is how we want our partners to act. And it's a little brutal at times, but it makes a lot of sense. And in frothy times, bank the money for something not working.
Mm-hmm.
If not the financial markets, your science, your technology, so you can live to fight another day.
You picking up on that? Any positive indicators here for the coming?
I was on a panel in the December timeframe, and someone asked me, "What's next year going to be like, Rob? You know, is it going to get better than this year?" And I said two things. I said, "One, I feel the M&A is picking up, and it has. It's exploded." And I said, "I feel like it's going to start picking up." I said, "The key for biotech is interest rates need to come down. We need to not have another war." That night, Hamas invaded Israel. So everyone on the panel was texting me the next morning saying, I guess we're going to have another war. And I said, gee, I really hope it doesn't go global. But I think despite the global issues that we see, and hopefully they stay no worse than they are now. Certainly we don't have conflict over Taiwan or something. I think we will, biotech's feeling a whole lot better this year than it did last year. In my opinion, I think a lot of it has to do with the willingness of people to take a little more risk, do deals. People are just, there's more movement. I can feel the gears moving. I think investors are getting exits that they need to redeploy capital. So I think we're going to have, it won't be, I hope not, frothy, but I think it'll be an environment that will sustain great science.
Excellent. Well, here's the 2024. Here's to you for joining me. I know it's very busy.
I appreciate it. No, I appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
And it's been a tough morning just with a couple things.
I know. No, we met. We planted some seeds for future episodes. I'll have Mrs. Jacobian on. Maybe you can come on together. That would be a really cool episode. The husband and wife.
Yes.
You know, like dinner time conversations between two.
Talk. Yeah.
Oh,
she's fantastic. So you'd love her.
Yeah,
we'll do it.
Well, thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I'm Matt Piller, and you just listened to The Business of Biotech, the weekly podcast dedicated to the builders of biotech. We drop a new episode with a new exec every Monday morning, and I'd like you to join our community of subscribers at bioprocessonline.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our never spammy, always insightful monthly newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. If you have feedback or topic and guest suggestions, hit me up on LinkedIn and let's chat. And as always, thanks for listening.